Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Today we're revisiting stories from our series Saguaroland, where we examine the desert we live in season by season through music, art, literature, food, drink, flora, and fauna.
Sun and sand, sagebrush and tumbleweed, rolling mountains and giant cactus.
From our armchair seat in the sky, we see Arizona's famous Valley of the Sun at Phoenix. Camelback Mountain is outlined on the horizon.
Yes, this Labor Day, we're bringing you some of those stories of home in the desert, beginning with our first guest, someone who spends a lot of time studying wildlife here, or maybe I should say spying on it.
I've really fallen more in love with wildlife by studying them using wildlife cameras.
Emily Burns is the program director for the Sky Island Alliance, and they have wildlife cameras stationed across the region, triggered by the heat and motion of animals as they go about their lives.
And so it's a really unobtrusive way to document animal activity, their behavior, and it has allowed us to see what is going on in these habitats when we're not there. You know, when humans go to bed, many of these mammals are out at night in these remote places where we can't be there as often as we would like to in the field. Yeah. We can leave these arrays of cameras out and it gives us this wonderful picture of which species are here and what they're up to.
What's the craziest species you've captured on one of these cameras?
Our biggest surprise has been the North American porcupine.
This species is not common in our region, and they weren't so easy to find, even on camera.
The first photographs that our cameras took of what we now know were North American porcupine were complete mysteries. They just looked like spiky, fuzzy beasts out there roaming around through the grass, and we couldn't figure out what animal it was. And it wasn't until we finally got a photograph that showed the tail that we realized what animal we were looking at. And then eventually we've been able to get video and nice portraits of them and their faces. But it was just a real surprise. They're living in cottonwood trees along the Santa Cruz River, right at the U.S.-Mexico border.
And the North American porcupine is just one of the multitudes of species Burns has found inhabits this biodiverse region. Within the Sonoran Desert sits what are called the Madrean Sky Islands.
The Sky Islands are these amazing mountain ranges that jet up out of the desert, and you can see them from so many miles away because they are so tall.
There are 55 different sky islands in this region, to be exact, stretching from southern Arizona down to Sonora, south of the border, and even into parts of southwestern New Mexico. From the desert floor to the mountaintops, they can reach over 10,000 feet in elevation.
And if you imagine traveling from the Sonoran Desert, where you're walking around among the saguaro, and start heading upslope into these mountains, it transitions into grassland and then beautiful oak woodlands that remind me of California. And you keep going and you get into pine-topped forests at the top of these mountains, and the climate is so dramatically different. It's much cooler. It's usually much wetter.
They are some of the most biodiverse and environmentally unique regions in the world, and a haven for scientists studying the ways that plants and animals evolve to their surroundings. And to Burns, they are a place to be protected.
They say that driving from the bottom of a sky island to the top is the same as moving from the southern border of the U.S. in Mexico, driving all the way up to the Canadian border, because things shift so much in terms of vegetation and climate.
Well, that's amazing. So the regions are incredibly diverse and also incredibly biodiverse, right? Like, describe for us why the Madrean Sky Islands that exist right here are so unique and more unique than like other sky islands that exist in the world.
Right. Well, these aren't the only mountains of this size around the world, but we're in this amazing crossroads in North America where we get a blending of a bunch of different ecosystems. We have the Sonoran Desert. We also have the influence of the Chihuahuan Desert. Then we get neotropics coming up from Central America that overlap in this region. And then we have the influence of the Rocky Mountains. And so these islands are like stepping stones between the Sierra Madre in Mexico and the Colorado Plateau. And they have all these corners tucked all over these mountaintops with niches for different types of species. And so this is where temperate blends with tropical, and every animal and every plant finds a place somewhere on the mountains.
And they're separated from each other. So it's like a really interesting way to study or place to study evolution, right? Of plants and species?
Exactly. These mountains are called islands because these forests in so many ways are isolated. They stick up in elevation, up in the sky, and they're the forests on the top are an island away from the next one. They're separated by the desert and also by expansive grasslands. And those habitats are really different. It doesn't mean that animals don't move between the sky islands. And that's one of the things that I work on the most is thinking about how do we allow this region to help animals on the move be able to reach different sky islands so they have access to all the habitat they need. Not everybody realizes that we have American black bear here in Arizona.
It's no, I did not.
Right. And they live in the mountains and they will venture down and you might encounter them in the desert as they're moving between sky islands. They'll come down and apparently they will look for prickly pear fruit from time to time. So you may see them, but they are moving between the habitats that they depend on the most, the oak woodland forests and the pine forests. And they're more common in the Arizona Sky Islands than they are in Sonora, and they're endangered in Sonora. So when we think about habitat conservation in the Sky Islands, if we can make this region habitable, passable for bears and help them thrive, hopefully we can help them repopulate in Sonora as well.
That's so interesting. So let me talk to you a little bit about what you love about Sky Islands. Like this is part of your work, obviously, but why are you passionate about this?
I've really fallen in love with the region because you can't go outside and not see so many different species. I was completely shocked just to learn about how many different animals we have in this area. More than half of the birds in North America either live here or fly through here during their annual migration. And there's 114 different species of mammals, which is more than anywhere else in the conterminous U.S. These are species like black bear that I was talking about. We have four different cats, bobcat, mountain lion, ocelot, and jaguar. We have American badger, North American porcupine, four different species of skunks. And it's just such a rich environment to encounter all of these species. And some of them have tropical origins and some of them are temperate. I love that blending pot that we get to experience so much of what makes North America rich right here in this area.
Yeah. So we have to also talk, Emily, about some of the threats that are facing this region, environmental threats, whether it comes to wildfires and climate change driven things like that, whether it's mining or just like human development. I know the border wall is a big discussion when it comes to preserving the Sky Islands, right?
Right. Well, because the Sky Island region is this diamond shape right north and south of the U.S.-Mexico border, everything that happens with border infrastructure goes right through the heart of the Sky Islands. And at this point, two-thirds of the U.S.-Mexico border in southeast Arizona has border wall, which means that the ability for animals to move between the Sky Islands on their historic migration routes or just to reach the habitat they need to have enough access to food, water, mates, and shelter is completely restricted. The wall is stopping animals in their tracks.
So let me ask you lastly then about sort of your hopes for the future or sort of your message here in terms of how we all might appreciate and experience the Sky Islands that we live so close to in this region. Like, if you're listening to this for the first time, you've never heard of this, how would you recommend someone go out and sort of get a sense of how magnificent these are?
Find a day where you can venture into a Sky Island. You know, take a picnic, bring your binoculars, bring a jacket. It's much cooler up there. This really, they call it Summer Haven on the top of Mount Lemmon near Tucson for a reason. Mm. And give yourself time to hike around and see just how many different habitats, how many different species are our neighbors here in the Sky Islands. I think that the more people that do that and understand how special this place is, the more we can work together to keep it as intact as possible for future generations. It's just, it's not replaceable. And it's really one of our best shared legacies here in this corner of Arizona and Northern Sonora.
All right. Emily Burns is Program Director for the Sky Island Alliance, joining us to talk more about this region. Emily, thank you so much for coming on, for your expertise on this, for all of this information. I love it so much. Thank you.
Thank you.
In our next conversation, we look at the Sonoran Desert through the lens of a camera, specifically the lens of Mark Klett's camera. Even if you don't know his name, you've almost certainly seen Klett's photos over the last several decades. He's been shooting them since he came to Arizona in 1982. His images feature iconic desert scenes, often including saguaros. Last year, I met up with Klett in his studio, which is just through the backyard of his Tempe home. The building, which he shares with his family, features several printers, computers, and boxes upon boxes of photos. And that's not to mention the nearly floor-to-ceiling desert images on the wall and the large-scale portraits taken by his wife that hang on one end of the studio. I began my conversation with Klett by asking how he looks at the desert differently now than he did when he started out in the early 80s.
Oh, yeah, it's kind of hard for me to even remember what I thought when I first came here in the 1980s, but it was definitely not a place I was familiar with. I came from Idaho, and it was February, and the first thing I noticed was it was nice and warm, and I thought, what am I getting myself into down here? But I had a lot of time on the weekends, and I would travel around to just try to understand this place that I lived in. I wasn't familiar at all with the desert, with the plants, the cactus, the way that the landscape looked, the geography. And so my way of introducing myself to it was just to go out and have an experience.
What about it appeals to you as an artist, as a photographer?
Well, that's an interesting question. The thing I was kind of poised to understand about this place was that it has the appearance initially of being a place that's untouched, and that's not true. And you go out and you start looking around, soon realize that there's a history here. And one of the things that does happen in the desert, unlike other places in the country, is that history often remains visible over time. So if somebody drives across the desert, for example, that track could be visible for decades and decades after that. If someone built a dwelling, say a Native American site, that could still be visible hundreds of years later. So that this record is, to me, really interesting, that you can see this history of the passage of people. And that's one of the things that really drew me to the place, was that I realized it wasn't just my experience. This was multiple experiences over time. So when I went out, I was looking for that. I was looking for the signs of that passage.
When you look at the desert and you're trying to find a spot, you know, a site to take your photos, what do you look for now? And I'm wondering if that's maybe different than what you would have looked for in the past.
Yeah, I think that when I first started, I was just photographing anything that seemed curious to me. One of the ways that you work, or I work as an artist, is that it's intuitive. I don't really know what I'm trying to do when I start. I go out there, and the first thing you have to do is just do something. So I'm photographing something I'm curious about, or maybe I like the light, or I like the composition, I can work with it. But after a while, then I'm thinking, what am I looking at? What kinds of things am I looking at? Why does it look this way? What's the history of something I'm seeing? And so that involves research. Well, what's happened to me over time is that I've built up a lot of that. You know, I've gotten to know the place a lot more. I've read a lot of the history, you know, and so when I go out now, I'm quite aware of things that I wasn't aware of, you know, 40 years ago. So I do make different pictures.
Do you have an estimate as far as how many photos of saguaros you've taken over the years?
No, I'd hate to estimate that. Well, I mean, it wouldn't seem too outrageous even if I could remember it, because I was working in the old days. I worked with film and a 4x5-inch camera. It's a camera and a type of way working that you don't work super quickly. Now I work with a digital camera, but it requires the same kind of thing. You have to put it on a tripod and set it up. So it's a slower way of working, but it's a much more detailed way. So, I mean, somebody today with a DSLR or a digital camera can go out and shoot just thousands and thousands of pictures in a short period of time on a card, which we wouldn't do in the old days because it cost too much with film, even if you could try to do it. So I haven't done that many. I would put the number in, say, the thousands, but it wouldn't be like somebody could do today with a different kind of camera.
What do you think that you learn about the Sonoran Desert through photographing it?
Well, again, it's that research. So I've been interested in saguaros, as you mentioned, ever since I got here. And I didn't know much about them when I started. I was responding to their shape, to the way they were articulated, to the kind of gestures that they made, their kind of reference to the human form, that sort of thing. But then over time, you know, I research more about saguaros and read about them. So, you know, I think that the research on any subject that I run across, that impacts my vision. You know, when I get that information, the next time I go out, I see things a little bit differently. So photography can start off as being a simple response to something. But I think in the end, for it to become meaningful, it often has to evolve in the way that it works into more knowledge.
Do you consider it maybe part of your mission or part of your job to teach people a little bit about the Sonoran Desert? I mean, your photographs are not just seen here in the valley. They're seen all over the country, all over the world. Do you feel that you're trying to maybe teach people or maybe get people to appreciate or understand the desert a little more through your photographs?
Well, I hope maybe appreciate. I don't know if I'm the best person to teach them really substantial facts about the desert. But I think if it makes people realize that this place isn't just an iconic, you know, desert where people might think, if they're not from around here, for example, they might think, oh, the desert's this dry, dusty place full of sand, and it's all the cactus have two arms that look like somebody sticking their arms up in a hold up. And, you know, if it's just not this iconic, generic view of what a desert is, but instead it's this really diverse land with an incredible history to it, that's the history layered with different cultures, you know. If that can get people to think about the richness of this place, then I feel good about it.
It's interesting what you say about how the perception of the Sonoran Desert for a lot of people who are not from here is that it's dry and dusty and not a lot lives here and not a lot grows here. You've been taking photos of it, as you said, since the early 80s. Have you gotten bored with it ever? Like, do you still see things, different things, or maybe look at things differently or find new spots that you maybe, you know, didn't know about before that really keeps it interesting?
No, I don't get bored. In fact, I've thought, or, you know, my wife and I have thought sometimes, you know, do we want to live someplace else? And we both agree that we just couldn't part with the desert. I think that it's just too important to me now. The experience of the place never gets old for me. It's a beautiful, it's a place where danger and beauty and uncertainty all come together.
What you're saying is, like, when you're out in the desert, it's the real thing. It's not Disneyland. It's not a national park. Like, this is it. Almost anything can happen out there.
Yeah, and I don't mean to denigrate the national parks, because they're still incredibly beautiful and gorgeous places, but I think it's not curated in a sense. There aren't any interpretive signs. There aren't any campgrounds where I go. There aren't any safety features, you know. And if you break down, you run out of water, or you run across a band of smugglers in the wrong place, nobody's going to help you out. You know, this is the place where, you know, you're taking charge of your own life at that point. And yet, it's also the place of incredible beauty.
Mark Klett, thanks a lot for having us here. I appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for coming.
And you're listening to The Show. Good morning. It's The Show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, we continue exploring our home, the Sonoran Desert, the lushest, hottest desert in the world.
But first, we're looking at the Sonoran Desert through the lens of design.
Any really talented architect or good architect knows what they're doing, listens to place more than anything. And this place really does have, has a lot to say.
That's Brian Farling, one of the principals at Jones Studio, an architecture firm here in the Valley that's made a name for itself as the place to go for modern, sustainable design inspired by the Sonoran Desert. The studio was founded in 1979 by Eddie Jones. He followed Frank Lloyd Wright and Paolo Soleri to the desert in search of the Sonoran landscape they prized. He was joined by his brother Neil a few years later, and they grew from there. Farling joined them straight out of school in 1998. A kid who grew up in Pennsylvania, he'd visited a cousin at the University of Arizona and fell in love with the desert.
Well, I really found that I love just sunny days and the sculptural qualities of, particularly down in Tucson, Saguaro Monument West, and the mountains, and, you know, just the sort of beauty of the raw desert.
I paid a visit to Farling recently to get a tour of one of the best places to experience what they do, their office in downtown Tempe. And we began the conversation with, what else? The sun.
The sun here is sort of very unique. And you could say that about anywhere. But here, you know, we have like 85% of the days are full of sun. And so if you're living in a space, that amount of light and the quality of that light really just sort of affects your environment, it affects your everyday, sort of everything that you do. You know, this space that we're sitting in right now, this conference room with the courtyard next to it, I just think it's a great example of connecting to that light, because you have that consistency of the light, but it's also brutal. So you have to be very careful and very deliberate with when buildings protect spaces from light. And then when they open up to it. So here we're opened up to the north with a tree, and the light is just, you know, dappled and beautiful and not direct ambient, and fills up this room. But we have the protected walls on the west and the south, you know, sort of keeping the damaging, you know, the more brutal aspects of the sun in check.
So you're thinking about the light a lot, not just in how it, you know, heats us all summer and like kills us, but also in the ways that it's beautiful. There's a double-edged sword there.
Yeah, the quality of light here is just remarkable. I mean, you know, if you travel, you rarely get to experience blue sky as much as you do here. And as long as you're protected from the oven that we all know summer to be here, I find it invigorating. It's just, you know, it just like fills me with happiness.
So the sun, obviously, and the light here, first thing, right, when you think about architecture and how to build for this place, what else comes to mind for you?
Water. This firm is very much obsessed with water in the desert and how we as architects can reinforce the fact that it's so precious and we have to be this amazing stewards. Mm. I'm very much obsessed with water, and I feel like here, you know, unlike most larger cities, or really most settlements across the earth, you're usually adjacent to a body of water. Think about the cities, you know, Chicago, New York, Los Angeles, cities in Europe. There's usually a river or a lake or an ocean. Here we're sort of out in the middle, you know, of this beautiful desert, disconnected to our water. I feel like, you know, that level of connectedness with our water is something that we have to do, just like those other cities are connected to their lakes and rivers and have that sort of, you know, very visceral, immediate connection with how much water they have and where it comes from.
So when you're designing for that appreciation of water and sort of recognizing that disconnection, what does that look like?
So it can look like a lot of things. There's a lot of history of indigenous people being just very smart with capturing water. So it can be deliberate like that, where water comes off the roof into a barrel and you collect it. Yeah. But it can also be experiential. So there's a project, the Mariposa Land Port of Entry is sort of the extreme example of capturing water. So we have a 1 million gallon water harvesting system that irrigates the 54-acre site.
And that this is, we should explain, a port of entry to the U.S. from Mexico and down on the border.
Right. The General Services Administration is a project, very high aspirations for making very, you know, important and powerful architecture, a welcoming gesture, believe it or not, a welcoming gesture to people coming across the border. So the design was focused around this idea of what does that gesture look like and how do you make it meaningful and dignified? So we thought, if we make an oasis, if you enter into a desert oasis, a garden, that's a very human thing and a very powerful way to greet people and for their experience and for all the people that are working there. So how do you do a garden in the desert? How do you do an oasis in the desert? You have some kind of water source, and hopefully it's not connected to the city plumbing system. So every building down there and lots of the parking areas and roadways drain to specific collection points. Mm-hmm. And there's some sort of very deliberate sculptural water scupper that celebrates when it rains and reminds everybody there that water is precious and that it's feeding the garden that everybody's enjoying on this port of entry. Mm-hmm.
So you're gathering the water that comes down. This is not water features in the sense that, like, we're going to put a fountain here. It's natural water.
It is natural water, but certainly fountains like you think of in Las Vegas and just very sort of over-the-top fountains are one thing. But as just in this courtyard right out
here. Yeah, there's one right outside here.
We have a little dribbling fountain that sound of water as you enter, you know, and as you experience that space. At Mariposa, we actually keep the water that's in the tank clean by aerating it through some small fountains that are in this gathering courtyard. So that sound, I mean, we all know that sound. It's a very human sound, and everybody loves it.
So that's really interesting because I would have never thought of architecture and thought of sound, right? And thought of like that sort of aspect of the senses. It sounds like you're really working with all five senses here.
We try to, yeah. I mean, I think aspirationally, I think all architecture, the entire built environment in the Colorado River watershed, Southwest, should be reminding everybody that lives here how precious water is all the time. And those are moments to define what desert architecture is. Because if the architecture is formed and shaped and deliberate with the way it's dealing with water, that's something that's extremely unique to this place. And so that is a definite, I think that's a definition of, or sort of a ground rule for, you know, doing desert design.
And this space in particular, like this office that we're sitting in here, is obviously designed in this way. Do you want to go take a look?
Yeah, sure.
We made our way into the main office, a long, narrow room with a folded, angular ceiling. And I was introduced to the firm's founder, Eddie Jones.
Hi. Pleasure nice to meet you.
What is the thought behind this ceiling? It's got an interesting sort of pattern to it.
It's structural. You see that unusual block wall outside? Well, it's structurally unstable. So the steel tube on top connects to the steel forks, which connect back to the building column line that you see here, and then that these folds in the ceiling kick all the lateral forces back to the center of the building. Now it's obvious.
It seems clear now, yes, but it's beautifully done, and there's such a use of light there too, right?
Yeah. Well, we prefer colored light over paint because colored light will dissipate the color as opposed to a sharp paint line. And when you talk about desert architecture, you know, people immediately think about how to, you know, passively cool and perhaps even harvest rainwater. Maybe Brian talked about that. But, you know, we always have sunshine. And so putting a building in a garden is perhaps easier here than it would be up in a northern climate. And the other quality of the desert is the light. We're always guaranteed light. So we put it to work.
In the winter, this folded ceiling, there's a clearstory strip of glass up high on the south. The light comes in, and this red floor is up on the mezzanine as well. The light comes in and bounces, and we always have this pink ceiling in the winter, and it starts to go away this time of the year because the sun's much higher, you know, in the sky.
Yeah. It's inspiring to work in this building. Generally speaking, it's inspiring to work in architecture, and that's why we try to create architecture for all of our clients and all of the users that are going to be impacted by our buildings. You know, everybody deserves to be inspired, right?
That was my conversation last year with Eddie Jones and Brian Farling of Jones Studio.
And you are listening to the show.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Artist Rebecca Pipkin works with invasive plants from a basin at South Mountain and transforms them into art. Pipkin boils down the plants into dye and then uses it on textiles she turns into sculpture. Sometimes she also turns the plant fibers into paper, which she also uses in her art. Pipkin likes to refer to the plants she uses as non-native instead of invasive, as what does and doesn't qualify as invasive species constantly changes. Last year, I took a trip down into the basin with Pipkin. She estimates she's visited the space roughly 80 to 90 times within the last couple of years. She doesn't find herself getting bored of the scenery, as the basin itself never looks the same twice.
I was collecting all those plants to make dyes with as a way to index participating in a local ecology. And that's kind of what these attunement walks have become as I've brought other people out here and continue to do this work and this research, has been trying to think of ways to help people be present in the places in which we dwell and thinking about being participants as opposed to kind of just walking on the surface of the earth or walking on the surface of the desert. We actually are like deeply embedded in the ecology of the Sonoran Desert, and particularly here in Phoenix. And for me, it's particular to this basin.
Well, and in this case, we are literally going to be walking into the desert, like we're walking down into a hole in the desert.
Yeah, exactly. But you get to kind of move through this site that holds you and think about like being small in something really vast.
Should we take a walk?
Let's do it.
So Pipkin and I set off into the basin. As we hike down, she says she became interested in the site because she was thinking about plants and the way living things move through the desert. She describes her work as site responsive and pays special attention to how the basin changes through the seasons and over time.
We have a habit of like talking about places as these things that you can like put a fence around, when in reality, place is like an ever-changing thing. It's more of an event where there's a gathering of unique beings at any particular moment, and we get to participate in that. But at the same time, like, you'll never, like the phrase, like, you'll never stand in a river twice, same river twice, you'll never stand in the same basin twice.
It, tell me a little bit about how you have seen this spot change, because yeah. It's obviously, it's very green right now. It's kind of a cloudy, mildly rainy morning here.
Yeah.
So it's very green, very verdant. But I would imagine you come out here at other times of year, it looks totally different.
Totally different. Yeah, so if you come out here in the middle of the summer, It's gray. There's not a lot of things living and growing down at the bottom of the basin. It looks totally different when the palo verde are blooming. It looks totally different when the desert brush bushes, which are these plants right here, when they're blooming. And then there's this new, it's new to the Sonoran in a way, comparatively, but there's this new plant called careless weed. It's how a lot of people refer to it, and it's this like bright pink fluffy weed that is categorized now as invasive. And so at certain times of the spring last year, this was like bright pink all the way through the bottom.
It must have been beautiful.
Yeah, it was stunning. It was beautiful. This is actually the greenest I've ever seen it.
In addition to all the green around us, there were erosion paths all along the sides of the basin, tracking where water had gone down into it. Pipkin says she sometimes makes paper castings on those slopes, which she then turns into textiles or sculptural pieces. She considers them another way to index how the site has changed and continues to change, as well as to think about how transient living things adapt and locate themselves in a new environment.
I grew up living all over, and I've moved a lot in recent years, and so I was looking for these like metaphors in landscape that I could kind of relate to about like how people move and evolve and adapt to new places. And invasive plants, I read this great book called The Next Great Migration by Sonia Shaw, and invasive plants just became one avenue by which I could kind of think about and track how these things were moving.
As we continue walking, we get to a bit of a clearing at the bottom of the basin, and Pipkin stops. We pause just to look, listen, and feel.
It's not huge down here, but there's a lot going on.
Yeah, there is a lot going on. And, you know, when you look closely, it's not like a perfect nature preserve. It's a weird hole, like, in between this housing development. There's the water tank, there's city property. It's technically in the state park, but it's also, like, there's trash here. And so one of the things I think about a lot is, you know, what is nature and what do we classify as nature and, like, where do we assign value for nature?
Pipkin says the silence inside the basin really stands out, especially since downtown Phoenix is so close you can see it from the rim.
We are really dwelling in an ecological system that was here before us and has adapted to us being here, and we have to adapt to living here as well.
Pipkin estimates she's been down there 80 or 90 times in the last 2 years and says a lot of her work is thinking about how to avoid getting numb to a place you spend so much time, but rather become sensitive to its intricacies.
The language that we use to kind of describe our experiences as humans is really closely related to botany. Like, we're talking about being rooted or transplants or uprooted. And so the crossover between the way that plants move and exist in a landscape, I think, is deeply applicable to the way that humans do too.
How did you come up with the idea to turn these plants into dyes?
Natural dyeing in textile arts is ancient. I feel really strongly that the forms that I have in my sculptural work, the colors that I have in my textile work, they're not made up by me, but they're made kind of through mutual involvement between site and artist.
How do you think that doing this kind of work has changed your perception and your perspective of the desert?
Yeah, I mean, I love the desert. I grew up on the beach. I've lived in mountainous areas. But for me, like, the desert is ancient. It is, like, adaptable. It is survival. And yet it's flourishing continually. And so I think there's something really nice in thinking about how care is scalable. And if you can care about the way that, like, a particular plant that maybe doesn't, quote, belong here, is moving through a basin in the middle of the city, that care is scalable to, like, many other things.
Pipkin says she likes the fact that just as the basin itself will never be the same twice, the dye she makes from the plant she collects there will similarly always be different, even if just slightly. For her, natural dyeing is a way to get to the essence of what a place is producing, literally boiling it down and extracting its most basic state. There's always an element of discovery, she says, just like the Sonoran Desert itself.
And this is the show.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. On today's show, we have been exploring our home here in the Sonoran Desert and the way this place touches every aspect of life in this corner of the world. Next, we revisit a conversation about the desert in bloom.
So we are at the Pima Dynamite Trailhead of Scottsdale McDowell Sonoran Preserve.
Melanie Luchek is the Director of Science and Education for the McDowell Sonoran Conservancy.
We are going to be going down the axle grease trail, which looks extremely promising for wildflowers because we have a lot of good vegetation cover there.
Let's hit the trail. It's the very beginning of wildflower season here, and this year's is expected to be a big one.
If it's not a super bloom, it's going to be very, very close. We've gotten a lot of rain. We've gotten the rain at really good times, nice soft rains during the winter, moving on into the spring, and exactly what the wildflowers need to come out in force.
And it doesn't take long for us to spot our first blooms.
These are one of our very first wildflowers of any season. They're called fiddleneck.
That's a great name.
Yeah, and they're named because the flowers actually bloom on a little inflorescence. That's sort of the stalk on which the flowers bloom that is curled like the neck of a fiddle. They also call that a scorpioid inflorescence because it's kind of like a scorpion tail as well.
It does. It curls right like that. That's really beautiful. So these are the first you usually see?
Yes. Almost always. They're the first ones out of the ground. They're the first ones to start blooming. They're our workhorse species.
Even this early in the season, before the poppies come out and before yellow brittlebrush blankets mountainsides, the signs of the coming bloom are everywhere.
This is, I'm going to confirm, hold on, I'm looking for the seed heads to tell me exactly what this is. This is bladder pod.
Oh, another great name.
Yeah, you know, plants have really fun names. A lot of them do. This one is in the mustard family. There's a lot of early spring blooming plants that are in the mustard family. And if you're wondering if they actually taste like mustard, it depends on the plant.
It's been a bit of an odd year for wildflowers in the Sonoran Desert, from an onslaught of unexpected rain to late-season freezes to a few brief spikes into the 80s. The patterns are different this year.
There was a lot of worry, I think, among our stewards, our volunteers, that the freezes were going to kill off the little seedlings as they were coming up. But, you know, the desert finds a way, and that hasn't happened.
It does seem to find a way. We stopped here. You spotted something, I think?
A couple more bladder pod, and it's right up against a shrub that is also blooming. You're kind of getting the hidden desert tour of this because these are not the flowers that you jump out at you, but this is another really important species in the desert. This is called ambrosia or triangle leaf bursage. And you can see the flowers, they haven't opened yet, but they're starting. If you look all around, the shrub is everywhere. It's sort of the mainstay of the Sonoran Desert. Of course, it's really important for pollinators and other wildlife, and it provides shade and kind of a nurse plant situation for a lot of other plants. You can see right here, there's a buckhorn cholla growing right up in the middle of it.
Like literally out of the middle of this shrub, there's a big cholla. So it grows because the ambrosia's here?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, as a small seedling, you can imagine how vulnerable a little tiny cactus would be to small critters that like to chew on it for its moisture. And so to grow in a shrub like this not only gives it a little protection, but also a little extra shade and a little extra water.
That makes a lot of sense. All right, let's keep it going, huh? So I have to ask you, because you have such a detailed knowledge of what we're looking at here, how did you get into this?
Yeah, so my background is wildlife ecology. I love nature. I love learning everything about it. And I was lucky enough to land in an organization where I get to lead the science and the outdoor education.
Did you spot something else here?
I did.
Oh, look at this.
So this is a Christmas cholla, and we're not looking at the flowers, but we are looking at the fruits of it. So this is a very like pencil thin cactus with large yellow or orange spines and little, probably like half inch long red fruits all over it. And they call it the Christmas cactus because it, you know, it kind of looks like Christmas lights.
It does. It does. They look like little red bulbs on it.
Yeah. And it really, this is really important for wildlife. As you can imagine, a lot of things like to eat those juicy little red fruits, including humans.
They're edible.
Yes, they are. But I would always caution people to know exactly what they're looking at before they try anything.
So that's really interesting. So you said, okay, wildlife ecology is what you studied and what you focus on here. And obviously you have a lot of knowledge about the Sonoran Desert itself. So how do wildflowers and sort of the blooming season that we're in here, how does that play into it? Like when you have a super bloom, when you have a lot of things blooming because of a lot of water and because of a lot of rain, what does that mean for everything else? The ecological system here, the plants, the insects, right?
Yeah, so the plants, like we think of them as kind of the bottom of the food chain or the foundation of the food chain. The more plants there are, the more herbivores, the more pollinators, and the more omnivores that are going to eat, you know, the other plants and the other animals. And then that goes all the way up the trophic system to our top carnivores. So when you have a super bloom, it really kicks off, it kind of kickstarts the whole ecosystem. You have more insects for the birds to eat. You have more rabbits and more quail, you know, for coyotes to eat and bobcats. You have a lot more forage for deer. And especially as things are growing, you know, plants that are growing quickly, they're putting their proteins into kind of those growth functions. And so that provides a lot of nutrition for animals like deer. And when you have more a healthy deer population, you have a healthy mountain lion population and and the whole cycle. So
the cycle of life as it is.
Exactly. One thing that's interesting is when we talk about wildflowers, which are often, we think of these little tiny plants kind of close to the ground, these kind of succulent little plants. Mm-hmm. And for a long time, people thought that the quail population had to do with like the amount of water out there. You know, if you had a lot of water, you'd have a really good quail year. But it's actually the vitamin A in the wildflower plants that controls how well your quail population establishes that year.
That is so fascinating and like so detailed, right? It's this one vitamin that has this big effect on quail, which are so ubiquitous here.
Yep, absolutely. That controls the reproduction. And then if you can imagine, all the things that eat quail are going to be doing really well too. Ooh, I do want to stop and just have you take a deep breath right about here. No, I got a little bit of horse. What I'm going for is, do you smell any kind of a sweet smell?
Yes, absolutely.
What is that?
That is the mistletoe
in those trees. Are those Palo Verdes?
Those are Palo Verdes. And those masses in the Palo Verdes are native mistletoe. Huh. And that is in bloom. And when it blooms, it releases the most incredible, like, honey sweet scent.
I've never known what those are. They look like sort of a bunch of weeds hanging in a tree up there. There's another big bunch right there.
Yeah.
Wow. So it's mistletoe?
Desert mistletoe. And a lot of people think that it's invasive or that it's hurting the trees. In actuality, it's playing a very important role in the ecosystem. When a tree is very old and declining, it will attach itself to it. And it does draw some nutrients, but it doesn't kill it per se. But what it does do is feed the bird populations.
So I want to ask you as we keep going about what you love about the Sonoran Desert itself, right? Like it's a unique desert. It's the most biodiverse desert in the world, correct?
Mm-hmm. Like that's correct.
What do you love about it?
Oh gosh, where do I start? I moved here 20 years ago from Minnesota, and I had no idea just how diverse and how unique each and every one of the life forms were that I would find here. You know, we tend to think of cacti as just kind of like, well, it's a cactus, right?
Yeah.
No, it's it's so much more than that. And the closer you look, I think this is the thing I love the most about the Sonoran Desert, is the closer you look, the more you see.
Yeah. Yeah.
Something that can appear kind of small, insignificant, or just kind of a lot of brown on the outside, you get closer and closer and you see just this infinite diversity of plants and animals and these really just ingenious adaptations.
It's all built to survive.
Exactly.
Melanie Luchek, thank you so much for showing me around this morning. It's been so beautiful.
Thank you.
And that'll do it for this Monday Labor Day edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. Remember, you can follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. For Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.